Well, hi there, football fans. Welcome to the important post-game show. As you know, those of you who watched the Patriots, and my engineer Ernie Skenton is thrilled about it, won the game in one of the dullest Super Bowls in history.
I'll just say I'm thrilled because I won a couple bucks. It's not that I love the Patriots.
And I wasn't particularly impressed with the commercials. I wasn't particularly impressed with the halftime show. Given what they pay for the halftime show, I'm going to suggest that next year, perhaps they will entertain my three guests for the next 45 minutes, Steve Monroe, Andy Schultz, and Keenan Kyles, who were part of an upcoming show called The War to End All Wars. This is a show. Welcome, gentlemen, first of all. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
No one was willing to come in last week because of the vortex, but now it's nice to have everybody back in the saddle. This show is kind of a cabaret incorporating music and stories and a lot of other things, all hooked on World War One. I need to know how this show came to be. What's the seed of this show?
Well, really, Andy and I met after seeing a production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yep.
One of Andy's vocal students. And we just got to talking about musicals. Andy is involved in many things, which he'll let you know about a few of them.
Sure, I want to know. I want to get to know, and yeah. I want the listeners to get to know all three of you, too.
I have a musical theater background, You know, I go back in time to the Kingston Mines Theater. I take that back. I go back to Bob Sickinger. He's the one that
really...
I remember
Bob Sickinger.
He got me going.
But you were in the original Grease?
Yes.
With Gary Houston.
Right. Polly Penn.
Polly Penn. That's right, Mary Lou Henner.
Yeah, who has a new TV show now, I think, right
she
now.
She does?
Yeah, I just saw in a Super Bowl commercial.
That's a durable career.
Yeah.
No one from that show. There was a guy named Steve Canning, I think, who was taken from the
Jim
Chicago...
Jim Canning,
yeah. Who was taken... But no one else was taken from the Chicago cast to the, you know, it once was the longest-running musical on Broadway.
Well, he wasn't originally... He was in the original Broadway cast, but they didn't cast him initially. They had a hard time finding Duty. You know, later on, Travolta plays Duty.
Oh, sure, you know? Sure.
That's how he gets introduced into the cast. But Canning was the only, but really, Mary Lou joined later, you know, when they were putting a roadshow together.
Let me ask you before we get into your careers, gentlemen. What did you think? I saw the original at the Kingston Mines twice, maybe because Polly was in it and Gary Houston worked for my dad, so I got free tickets to sit in that, what was a crummy former, you know, the bus barn or something. What did you think of the show, Steve, when you were written?
I was the only one in the cast that thought it was a monster hit.
Really?
Literally, I was the only one in the cast. Even the director, Guy Burriel, didn't think it was. I knew it was. I just, you know, I had worked with Jim.
Yeah.
And Warren, you know, was a...
Warren Casey and Jim
Jacobs,
was
a fantastic actor. And they started Kingston Mines Theater, along with June Pekosik and Jack Wallace and others. And I had already been familiar. I'd worked with Jim at Hull House.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what a great actor he was. And his energy is unbelievable. And just the energy alone and his story combined with, and this was the magic, was Warren Casey's his sense of humor.
Yeah.
His ability to be funny in the songs. Like It's Raining on Prom Night is a perfect example. Our favorite song, by the way. The entire cast sang it every night, never got tired of it.
We'll talk.
You could hear us in the audience.
We'll talk later in this segment about reuniting you being in the cast for that American Theater when they did the original show 40 years later.
Yeah.
So, Andy, you two guys start talking to each other.
Right.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, of course, being of a vintage way, way before World War One. But so what did you say to each other? What was it about World War One and the music and the stories of...
Well, I'm not exactly sure how it came out, but Steve said that his grandfather was in World War One in the Lafayette Escadrille. And I said, wow, that's a good starting point. I bet we could find all kinds of interesting things to do, both musically and theatrically, relative to World War One, and that we can do something that is very rarely done. We can make it personal.
Yeah.
We can talk about our families and talk about our memories and talk about
people. You have a familiar familial connection too, don't you, to World War One?
Well, I think everybody I'm sitting next to ultimately is going to have a familial connection to World War One. But mine is a little interesting because my grandfather was in the German army in World War One.
Did you know your grandfather?
You know, I did not.
But you knew stories and
were all of the stories about what happened to him during World War One. I won't go in too deeply. But he was captured in the first week of the war.
And Steve, did you know your grandfather?
Oh yes, quite well. What really was interesting, he was, I think, classic. I've since learned, I've done some research, you know.
You would hope, you guys did some research.
But some wonderful organizations that I like to plug along the way.
Sure.
You know, well, I got Andy involved with the Centennial Commission, World War One Centennial Commission. It's national. Their main task is to build a monument. Believe it or not, there is no monument in Washington for World War One.
That's interesting.
And so they have created a design, and it's going to happen, but they still need additional funding. Jennifer Pritzker,
who runs the Pritzker Military Museum,
yeah, which is a wonderful place.
Oh, yes.
And they do presentations and everything. You know, we hope to perform there in addition, by the way. They want us. We're a good fit there, for sure. But we were involved in many of their meetings and affairs. And also at the UIC, we did a presentation during the week of the Armistice Week, where we performed with an orchestra of about 50 instruments.
You guys begin to conceptualize this show. Mm-hmm. Saying, hey, here's an interesting tune that would work here, and here's an interesting story. And then you go out and find this young opera singer, Ken and Kyles. When they approached you, Ken, and how did that work? Had you known these two gentlemen before?
Yeah, so I take voice lessons with Andy, and I also did a performance with Steve.
Oh, so they could easily put the arm on you.
I don't know how easy it was, but they were able to persuade me. Andy had... at one of our voice lessons had just mentioned that there was a whole regiment that was all black.
That's a fascinating element of this thing, because I certainly did not
from
know that.
Chicago.
Yeah.
And that was a way to kind of like spoon me in so that I could represent and pay homage to the 370th Infantry.
So how long have the three of you been working on this? You were supposed to have, I guess it was, it would have been your premiere show last week, and it got sort of derailed by the polar vortex, but you have shows coming up February 9th and 10th in Skokie, and another one coming up. We're going to give you all the information you need about that. But how long did it take all of you, because it's much bigger than just the three of you. There are about eight.
Well, about 2 years, I think.
Yeah, I think we've been working 2 years.
Including, we did a performance utilizing Andy's, primarily your students. And we did it at the Admiral, not the Stormy Admiral.
Yes,
the
right.
Admiral on the lakefront.
Oh, I know that well. Well, the great thing is, I know I went up and actually reviewed the astonishingly not talented Stormy Daniels when she appeared at the Admiral. But I have friends now, being of a certain age, who live at the Admiral up there. How did it go over?
It was great when we did it at the Admiral.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's part of what made us feel that we could take it to another level, because the Admiral is quite a sophisticated audience.
Oh, no question.
They just were eating it up. They were
Before us, they had Whiffenpoo in.
As you start to sort of put all this in the cauldron, the creative cauldron, you're doing it with the notion of what? I mean, being pragmatic about it, to make a theatrical presentation?
For me, yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
And having gone through Greece and other things other in my life, but Greece certainly was a great example.
No question.
Or Flora the Red Menace, that for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, that you can make something happen, you know, when you have great talent, the right energy, and help. You need a lot of help along the way.
No question. We want to, in the next segment, after a short commercial break, talk specifically about the narrative of this show, how you mix, and I'm always fascinated with the mix of story and song, and this sounds right up that alley. So I'll be back with Steve Monroe, Andy Schultz, and Ken and Kyle's after a short little commercial break. Welcome back. We're having a musical selection from Ernie Skatten, who is celebrating his Super Bowl victory. A few coins in his pocket. We're also talking with Steve Monroe, Andy Schultz, and Ken and Kyle's about their new show, The War to End All Wars, which is billed as a cabaret, but sounds very much to me like a theatrical performance. It's going to be, you can judge for yourself, on February 9th and 10th at the Old World Theater in Skokie, which is actually what? The Old World Theater is a temple.
It is the CKE.
It's a synagogue.
It is a synagogue. That our mentor, Bill Raffeld, who is really an unsung hero in the world of theater. I don't know if you know Bill.
Yeah, I know who he is, sure.
You know, taught many years, going back to Navy Pier.
Sure.
And even has an office still at UIC.
Wow.
And the keys to every room, practically, in the theater department. But he put together the alum, which I'm one of the alum, and we do a season of plays there. And he is open to anyone that was an alum now, not, you know, even if you were not a theater major there.
Yeah.
So occasionally it'll be a great treat for somebody who was going to dentistry, say, to be in the show.
That's what you want, dentists performing. Yeah. You say theatrical, and you label The War to End All Wars cabaret. All of you gentlemen, and just, you know, talk over one another. What's the narrative of this? Is it a one-act show? Is it a two-act show? Is it music alternating with stories? Tell me.
It is music alternating with stories. It isn't. Yeah. We have decided to put it into one act. Approximately an hour and 10 minutes is what the typical run would be. It is a mixture. Music is so important, though, to the soldiers who, you know, the main thrust here for me is to remember these soldiers, remember the people of that time, remember my grandfather especially.
Sure.
And to keep that memory alive for people close to me and to anybody who will listen. Because so many people know nothing or little.
See, this is one thing that intrigues me so much about it, in that I didn't know anything about the Black Devils, even though there is which was the 370th Infantry, even though there is a statue in their honor at 35th and King Drive. Keenan Kyle didn't know anything about it either, and that's one of the things that attracted you to it. Mm-hmm. This is, it's an interesting kind of hook you have here, in that it's not come celebrate your ancient ancestors, it's more, it's an enlightenment, don't you think, gentlemen?
Yes, and particularly about Chicago, too. So much happened here, so much transformed in Chicago because of World War I, the entire world, of course. But so many things happened here, going all the way. The committee still exists because of the race riots that occur in 1919.
Right. Sure.
We're still active on the committee about this, making sure that the plaque is improved upon. It is out on the lakefront that very few people know about.
I know.
That the students of York High School, Carl Sandburg's school, he was the one that was very responsible as a journalist about that, the race riots. I don't know if you've read about that or not.
Sure. Because there were, you know, anniversary pieces recently in the paper about it.
I was crazy about wanting to write something about Jane Addams, because Jane Addams, Hull House Theater, right?
Sure.
You know? And she loved theater. You know, absolutely loved theater. And she was a pacifist.
Well, and she also saw its value to kids who had nothing else. I mean, she saw the value of the arts in general. That's why Benny Goodman learned to play the clarinet there, for goodness sake.
And Jane Addams was President Woodrow Wilson's ear. He brought her to Washington 5 or 6 times for private conferences, without an interpreter, by the way, I think. And she was very important to him as he maintained his pacifism, which, of course, flipped, you know, after he got his election, of course, he suddenly, you know, decided we needed to enter the war.
Wow. Keenan, you interest me very much because you were a young man who was an opera singer.
Yes.
And opera, proverbially, recently is having, and you'll see stories about this everywhere, it's having such a hard time, even the lyric, attracting young people to opera. How were you drawn to opera?
As a child, I had joined the Chicago Children's Choir.
That's a great organization.
And from then on, I did the Gallery 37 program with Andy when I was like 12 years old. And he ran the operatics ensemble. And we did Le Nozze di Figaro, The Marriage of Figaro. We did Candide. So on top of having the Chicago Children's Choir that focused a lot on classical choral music,
right,
I had Andy that focused a lot on opera chorus and roles and things like that. And it was just something so interesting to me about opera that I did not hear at the time around my neighborhood. I grew up in Brainerd on the South Side.
I mean, you can say that, though. That's probably true of a vast number of Chicago's 70-something neighborhoods, whereas that you will not hear a lot of opera there.
Yeah. So just having that opportunity allowed me to form an escape and do something different that challenged me, that forced me to think about language different, characterization, and it just stuck with me. And I went on to Columbia, and I studied with Andy, and I still studied with him after I graduated. But he's always been that force behind me, really taking it serious.
Can you make a living at opera?
Oh, you can make a living, yeah. Of course you can make a living. It won't be like quick and
like
in a jiffy,
but
you know, you know, it takes time. Everything is hard. CNN and ABC did a huge story about me about working as a janitor support my career. So as a young opera singer, there's so many different avenues you have to take. Young artist programs and master programs and things like that. Language, it's just so many different loops that you have to go through before you actually hit that moment where it's like, oh, okay, I'm here. And I've had a lot of great accomplishments up until now, very surprising, very sporadically.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I'm happy with the route my career is going.
How old are you?
I'm 30.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That's still very young. This must, Andy Schultz, must make you very proud to hear.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, because I knew him when he was knee-high to a grasshopper.
Do you find many knee-high to a grasshopper people these days being drawn to opera?
I'm going to say that it's sometimes surprising.
Really?
Because don't think of it so much as opera, but as singing. There's something about singing that transcends all kinds of other cultural barriers.
And I suppose, and tell me I'm wrong, gentlemen, Steve Miner, I don't know how well you sing. If you were in the original Grease,
okay.
He's got to be okay. What do you mean? If you could sing with Gary Houston and Polly Penn, he's got to be okay. But I would think if you are a capable, and I'm just saying capable, I'm not talking about Keenan specifically, if you can learn to be a capable opera singer, that would open up all manner of other sorts of music to you. Yes,
I think so. I think, you know, to sing on the opera stage, you have to have other attributes besides just knowing how to sing. There's the nature of the size of your voice and other accomplishments that you need to achieve.
Well, and they're also, I mean, in singing opera, most people I know, most opera singers don't sing it in a bathroom. I mean, there is an acting and emoting component to it that will serve you well in any kind of sort of musical theater, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, break down this show for me.
All
the
right.
War to End All Wars.
The title, of course, was what they thought it would be,
yes.
The only war.
If only.
And Woodrow Wilson embraced that slogan.
He had
a few others, too. For me, though, you know, it is remembering my grandfather going on a road trip to Bemidji, Minnesota, you know, when I was about 12 years old, to visit one of his sisters. And the long journey, never wanting to talk about the war, didn't know how to get anything out of him pertaining to that. He just seldom spoke about the war, which is very typical.
Oh, sure, it's typical of my father in World War II, yeah.
Except.
So does it, the show is personalized then?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is
and
great.
And it is for everybody. And actually, even the segment on the Hello Girls, for instance, the actress that plays that part really is... It personalized it a great deal. This is an astonishing... I don't know if you're familiar with the telephone operators that were employed from AT&T.
Yes, that I know. My knowledge of history is so spotty, I can't even believe it.
I think it is celebrating history that really appealed to me here, to keep the memory really just going, and to the music... The variety of music.
No question. No question.
We were doing a show at Old World, the Sunshine Boys. Andy saw the production, I think. And my son, who is a musician, the music being played during intermission was Tin Pan Alley. Huh. And my son said, I like that music a lot. And I said, really? You don't like anything I do, but you like that. And
that was a big father-son rapprochement.
That stuck with me.
This is great.
Grandpa starts singing once he has some Cavazier with his sister. And he starts singing in Bemidji some of these World War I songs. And, of course, the one that stuck was Mademoiselle from Armored Tears.
That's how the show begins.
Yes.
We will continue on and try to give you a real taste of the war to end all wars and tell you the number to call and tell you when to call and what these fine gentlemen anticipate for the future of this show, which might include a trip courtesy of Jennifer Pritzker someplace, from what I hear. So please stay tuned. Tell me something good. Ernie Skatton is selecting the music for this edition, and something good is that the Patriots won, thereby increasing the bank account of engineer Ernie Skatton. I have a few more minutes left with Steve Monroe, Andy Schultz, and Kenan Kyles. We're talking about the War to End All Wars, which will be having its next performances February 9th and February 10th at the Old World Theater, which is at 5130 Toohey Avenue in Skokie at the synagogue there. Phone 312-857-8487. Ben Anderson will put that up on the site when you listen to this sometime later in the week. What are you expecting from the... I know you were, all three of you, expecting this to be a very polished and very professional show, which include about five or six other performers doing spoken... I don't know what they call it, spoken word, but reading excerpts and various stories focused on World War One and singing some of the songs of that era, especially songs that were somehow close to the soldiers who fought there. Is that about right?
Yep. I'd say.
We're not sure yet.
What we're trying to do musically is to present a real cross-section of all kinds of different things. We have art songs. We have an opera excerpt. We have popular songs. We have all kinds of different things from all kinds of different aspects of World War One. We have the very first thing, we have an opera excerpt from the opera Good Soldier Schweig.
Wow.
Composed by Robert Kirka from Cicero, Illinois.
Come on.
Yeah. That's going to be the very first large number. We're going to have French songs. We're going to have art songs. We're going to have music by Charles Ives, one of the big American avant-garde composers. But we're going to have some really great fun songs, such as You'll Have to Put Him to Sleep with the Marseillaise and Wake Him Up with an Ooh La La when he comes back from France.
A real
song by Harry von Tiltzer.
Wow.
Right?
So
Alexander's Band is back in Dixieland.
How many songs?
You know,
roughly.
Well, we shuffle them in and out, don't we, Andy? But
yeah.
I'd say there's about 20.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Actually, we have many, many more that we could use.
Sure.
As I mentioned, if we evolve the show.
How do you see, all three of you, how do you see the show evolving? Because I look at the show as it stands right now with these upcoming performances this week at the Old World Theater, and I see a tremendous, tremendous amount of potential here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, we're building a snowball, I think, with the audience. We're not the conventional type of production company that you see today. You know, so many of us went to college, like Steppenwolf, left. You know, what do you do next after leaving college? Let's start a theater company. Fortunately, many of these people have some money to begin with, with their parents and such.
Oh, sure.
That's the typical scenario.
You bet.
We looked, Andy and I looked into the not-for-profit status to try to raise some money toward this. And we just, you know, we decided just carry on with the show first. That's what we want to do. And, you know, we know that we're both experienced enough, I think. If it does catch on, we will find our match. We know of some people. I think if we invite them to the show, there might be something happening for us in a true cabaret fashion. In cabaret, it's interesting what that is. And, you know, here in Chicago, there were many at that time. You know, there were more theaters in Chicago during World War One. There were something like 800 theaters during World War One.
I know. Chicago. Well, and cabaret is something that, you know, I wrote about in Sunday's paper today about the old Gold Star Sardine Bar, which was one of the last kind of cabarets here. And Davenport's is still kind of cabaret-like, which would be a good spot for this show. I also think the Pritzker Military Library would be a wonderful venue for this show, and I know that Jennifer Pritzker, Colonel Jennifer Pritzker, would be all over this. Have you made a connection with Jennifer yet?
Oh, yes. Well, through her people, we've met her. I think, Andy, yes. I think you've met her as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we're on this committee, you know. And which was, you know, a good, very good thing. We enjoyed it. But we've met some of the people that work there. And unfortunately, their director left recently.
Right, right.
And so they have an interim director. Now they have just announced a new director. But from the people we know, I think we actually have a fighting chance to do the show. They want us to do it there.
Yeah, I'll bet they do.
I think it's a perfect. And they have a great recording studio, as you know, there.
They have state of the art everything there. Yeah. That's a great thing. You guys are too much. When you first sent me this note, Steve, I was terribly intrigued. And then meeting the three of you and learning about the three of you makes me even more confident that not only are you going to pull this off, but this is the foundation of something that will be a singular sensation, as they used to say.
Oh, okay.
A singular sensation. Accept. Yeah, I'll bet. And any guy who was in Greece with Gary Houston and Polly Penn.
And the original Greece, don't forget, is the only Greece to ever win an award.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Gentlemen, best of luck. Again, Ben will have the information on the website, but also you can call 312. Can you look up old world? You guys have a Facebook thing, don't you?
Not yet, no.
You don't?
The old world does, but we're doing a lousy job with it right now. So that is high on our list.
Okay.
We have been focusing on the music.
On the show itself.
The show. Yes.
On the show itself.
Yeah.
We'll keep at it. The phone number for tickets. 312-857-8487. It is February 9th at 8 o'clock and February 10th at 2:30. Steve Monroe, Andy Schultz, and Keenan Kyles, it is a pleasure to hear about this, and I'm going to follow it, too.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Oh, my God, my pleasure. The war to end all wars, if only that had been true. But it wasn't, so we carry on. We got to take a commercial break, then we'll have some artists and photographers in here. Scatton, who has won money on the recent Super Bowl, is euphoric here. He's the great engineer of this show, and he's allowed to pick all the music he wants to play. Tony Fitzpatrick, fresh off an airplane. I thought I was only going to be in here with his son, Max, but Tony has arrived. He is with his son, Max. They're both actors. Max is more a sort of business entrepreneur than you are, but you own a gallery, and at that gallery on February 8th, we'll open a show by two brilliant photographers who are also sitting here. What I said is, one said, well, we don't really speak English that well. And I said, well, Tony can talk for all of us. I don't speak English that well, and Tony can do this. Max, let me ask you first. Are you excited about this show? I have just been looking at the work of of Liza Mora and Caetano Avezzato, and couldn't stop looking at it.
Yeah. It's a real thing, man.
Yeah, we're really excited for this show, actually. You know, we met Caetano in Paris at the Renaissance Hotel, and he worked the front, and I'll be honest, I did not know how he felt about us originally.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Well, that's always the case. You know, I've known you since you were born, Max, and I've known your dad
41 years.
For 41 years, and you don't know what I think of you, for God's sake.
Well, I could guess sometimes.
you can guess.
Yeah, we took over the hotel lobby every night.
When
you
were over
night.
There filming,
yeah,
we were Patriot. Filming Patriot.
In the very, you know, wee hours of the morning. And
one night, Caetano showed me some of Liza's photos and some of his photos, and I said, I want to see more. And, you know, Paris was a rich thing for us. We met a lot of artists.
Well, it's changed. Yeah. I actually think it's changed your life creatively and artistically,
absolutely.
Tony.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm kind of crazy for the place. And these guys are originally from Brazil. So.
Right, right, right. How did you two wind up in Paris?
It's a few years ago, our country was really, really messed economically.
Yeah, Brazil, yeah, sure.
Know, completely stuck. Sure. It was hard to find a job. It was hard to pay the life. So we decided to move back to the Europe. Liz is a Portuguese descendant. So we went to Portugal to make some citizenship papers. We spent some time in Portugal. And then we moved to Paris. That was a France, actually. It was,
you know, Paris traditionally, and I've seen it happen with Tony and even with you too, Max, Paris traditionally has been the most nurturing ground for artists for centuries.
Absolutely.
It obviously remains so. It remains so for the two of you and for the Fitzpatrick clan over there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in every art form, too. And not just painting and drawing, not just photography. Not just filmmaking, not just writing. I mean,
there's a certain
heady mix of all of that.
There's a certain freedom there. What do you think it is, Tony?
I think that there's a statue in the Republic Square that says liberty, equality, and fraternity. And the liberty part they take real, real seriously. And artists have a pretty free hand in Paris. However regimented other things or intransigent governmental kind of things become, artists are given a long, long leash. You know, you would never see what happened with the NEA years ago here.
Sure.
But Paris right now is going through a lot of flux.
Tell me again what you thought. You met when Liza and Caetano were both working at the hotel.
Caetano.
Just
Liza,
Caetano.
I have not met yet.
And you and Max were misbehaving at the hotel.
Yes, we were. Yes, we were on a nightly basis.
and to shut you up, Caetano said, look, I have these photographs. Be quiet. I want you to look at this photograph.
Well, yes. I kept getting a little tiny ink spots on the carpet in the room because I was drawing.
Sure.
So I would give everybody a little etching and say, yeah, I'm really sorry I screwed up again. You know. And you know, Caetano and I started talking about art, you know, and he said, well, I'm married to a marvelous photographer, and I'm a photographer as well. So I said, do you have any on your phone? And he started showing them to me, and it's like, this guy's not casual. These two are not casual photographers. I see them right up there with, like, Dorothea Lange, Robert Capa.
So do I, after seeing absolutely. What you can see. What I need to ask all of you, though, because you know me, I don't know anything about photography except what I see and my visceral reaction to it. But in this day and age where every single human being with a telephone
has a camera.
Believes, well, they believe, not only they have a camera, they believe themselves to be photographers.
Not me. I
mean, what? It's not me. Neither do I, because I've worked with enough professionals in the pre-phone era.
John White,
Charles Osgood, Chuck Cherney, there are a million of them,
exactly.
Chris Walker, that I want you all, the four of you, you two, Max, to tell me what a photographer is in this era where everybody is a photographer. Max, what do you think that
means?
I struggle with this question all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have an Instagram, but I don't consider myself a photographer.
Right.
I have a lot of friends that are photographers and are putting themselves out there as that, but it's so weird. We all do have our phones. We all can tell a story. I think it's just a matter of, like, who's actually putting those stories together and, you know, whether they want to actually tell that story. I think there's people definitely telling stories right now, and they don't even know it, and probably in years to come, they're going to look at all these pictures and be like, wow, I have something to tell from my past, or maybe, you know, I have something to tell right now, but I don't know. I think anyone can be an artist or a photographer. It's just like, do you really want to put your mind to that? What story do you want to tell? And, you know, where can you tell this story? I don't know. It's such a complex question.
Yeah. Tony, what do you think?
We just lost the great photographer Mark Hauser. And what I always noticed about him and every great photographer whose work I've ever looked at, and I include Caetano and Lisa in this.
Absolutely.
They wait for the moment where whatever they are aiming their camera at reveals itself. And sometimes it's only a second. And they get it. They get the lightning into the bottle.
And
there's no hiding in photography. You either catch the salient, transcendent moment, or you don't.
What part of that's very well put, Lisa and Caetano? What part of the photographer comes into the photo? What I could look at an Instagram all day and not be as moved and touched in an inexplicable way that I am by your work. There are a couple pictures of yours of children that just almost knocked me out of a chair. I have to believe that there is something of the photographer that goes into the photo. I know that's not even a question, but it's a philosophical concept. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Totally. As Lisa just told me right now,
tell that guy Rick to shut up, she said. Just that Rick's an idiot. Let Tony talk.
No, she told me exactly, to be a photographer on the days of today, the most important is you need to have a soul. You may do empty things, take your telephone and shoot every day doing empty things. Doesn't mean nothing, just a bunch of data. Then you can take your telephone or even a matchbox with a film inside with a pinhole and do an amazing job. So adding that, in my opinion, the most important thing is how can you transmit emotion to someone.
That's it. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I love to do analogy with kitchen because I work a long time in kitchen as well in France. You can do an omelette, a very bad omelette. You can do the most delicious omelette in life. It's still an omelette. It depends what emotion you're transmitting, what the thing you're preparing, you know?
Yeah.
A photographer is the same.
You have to, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to spell the names for you so you can go online and look at the work before Ben posts this later this week. Lizamoura. Got it? Lizamoura. That's the lovely woman sitting here. Mm-hmm. Her husband, also a photographer. Caetano, CaeTano. Azevedo, AzevEdo. So sometime after this show, sometime when you wake up, it'd be a marvelous thing. I'd like you all to have sleepless nights, wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then spend a couple hours with these two online.
And you can. If you started at 4 in the morning,
I guarantee you would.
I think the definition that I take from what Caetano just said is that to be a photographer today, you have to be able to absolutely, when you're shooting human beings, to heighten their humanity, to make us less afraid of people we don't know and who are not like us.
Yeah.
I often compare what they do to studs, to Tony Bourdain, who spent his life making this show about other cultures that made us all less afraid of each other.
Yeah.
So they have a couple of projects. One with the new refugees in Paris, the new immigrants. And I think particularly, I was talking with Caetano, and he said, you know, we're an immigrant people, you know?
Yeah.
And at the very heart of being Americans, we are an immigrant people.
Well, you two also, you and Max must have, and I got this sense because we talked a few times while you were in Paris.
Yeah.
You both had the feeling of being, you know, sort of strangers in a strange land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Trying to adjust, trying to learn how to mm-hmm. say merci beaucoup, however you might have
No, you know what I did? I had a Dodge. Oh, no. Rick, I had a Chicago Dodge for it. I would walk around with the most sincere look on my face and I'd go, désolé, je parle un peu français, you know? And I thought, whoa, what a sweet guy.
Yeah.
This poor elf can't speak French. Let's help him out, you know? But yeah, you do...
I mean, you felt that moment
of otherness.
Yeah, you two felt it viscerally. Even though with there, you have a lot of friends. You're making a great television series, but you had to feel it.
But oddly, I didn't run into anything other than unfailing kindness. Everyone was so nice to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there were guys telling me, well, you're going to run into a lot of haughty and snooty. It's like,
oh, that's nonsense.
Yeah, if you're a jackass, I mean, you run into a lot of haughty and snooty.
You find it like, right here.
People of France, or Paris more rather, I think they really looked at you and looked at what, you know, who you are and not what you have and where you come from and any of that. So there was a really genuine... just persona in the average Parisian, and they really do care about you. They really do wonder, you know, who you are, not just, you know, again, where you come from, what you have.
They're curious,
you know,
too.
Yeah.
Another element of Studs Terkel. We got to take a news break, but we'll be back with these four artists. I do think of you as an artist.
Beats hanging drywall, brother.
Yeah, no.
Anything to avoid on a
score. Long time since you've been hanging drywall, but stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.
Not wood.
Music. Courtesy of Ernie Skatten, the engineer of this show and the winner of the Super Bowl, in a small sense. Tom Brady may get more press, but Ernie may indeed be happier than Tom Brady is. I've got another half hour with my friends Tony Fitzpatrick, his son Max, Lisa Mora, and Caetano Avezzato, a couple of astonishingly talented photographers, whose exhibition will be opening Friday at the Dime Gallery, a Fitzpatrick Enterprise at 1513 Northwestern Avenue.
Plenty of parking.
Max, plenty of free parking.
Free beer.
It's everything. It's everything any artist, it's everything anybody who wants to buy a photograph could want.
Absolutely.
Max, talk about the Dime Gallery. You spend a lot of time there.
It's space. I've spent like 3 years of my life at the moment in that building. We have two galleries. We actually just had a show last night at our other one called Adventureland Gallery.
Right.
And we opened up another gallery called The Dime because we were just sort of, you know, overwhelmed by...
good art.
People who...
Yeah.
Yeah, good art. And then people
and
that we want to give shows. And we only have 12 months out of the year. And now with two galleries, we have 24 shows out of the year. And... yeah, I mean, it also gives an opportunity for this guy to show his work and display himself and not have to rely on, you know, Chicago representation, which is a really good thing in the art world. So
the politics of Chicago gallery scene.
It's ridiculous.
It's
we take
a little
no
weird.
Percentage of sales.
Yeah, I know, which is so rare. So rare.
Yeah, well, we found other ways to make money.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And, I mean, just we meet people and, you know, we don't have really a set plan of how our year goes. You know how we function.
I do, and I love the way you function. It's kind of...
When we see something we think more people would be excited about,
you trust your instincts, your aesthetic instincts.
Yeah.
And in a sense, this is the birth of this show by Lisa and Caetano. You saw their work in Paris And then Caetano, then these two characters who are making messes on the rugs of the hotel in which they're staying.
Well, and we also had conversations every night.
Yeah.
Because you know, he's the night man. He's the night manager.
And at what point, at what point did you say, hey, I have a gallery in Chicago you guys should show here?
I think from the start.
To Max, yeah.
I think from the start. Yeah, the first thing Caetano actually showed me was this landscape and this beautiful... is it a sunset or
I think
sunrise?
That's what I put on Facebook. I put that shot on Facebook.
I mean, it's just this beautiful peach sky and just kind of like these rocks and like little ponds there. But it's beautiful. And
painterly.
I think
it's gorgeous.
Yeah, from when I saw that photo, I knew I wanted to have him. I didn't think the show would happen this soon. I mean, it literally happened the next
now, Caetano,
year.
Did you believe these two jokers when they say, hey, we have a big gallery in Chicago. You come have a show here. You know, come on, Tony. It's like, you say, really? You have
a
show?
This guy has a gallery?
No one's ever going to see
me
again.
They wouldn't let this guy
Lisa, if
gallery,
we get on this plane and go to Chicago, no one will ever see us again.
They want to move here.
I would never do this kind of judgment.
you must have been excited about it. You have had, your wife... Lisa has had shows in Paris.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is this your first show in the United States?
It's the first time we've been in the United States. We've shown in Paris and Arles. Do you know Arles?
Sure.
City of photography in the south of France. So Lisa showed there last year. And in Paris, we did some a few group exhibitions, one solo exhibition. On the same series we're going to show here in Chicago.
How many pieces will you have at the Dime Gallery starting this Friday?
About 20 pieces.
20 each or 20 combined?
No, all combined.
20 combined?
Yes. Is this the first time you guys have ever shown together?
No, the solo show we did in Paris, there was a few pictures for me.
This must be very exciting for the two of you.
Yes, very exciting.
Tony and Max aside, I mean, I could not imagine working with two better, more fun and caring, nurturing people. But nevertheless, I mean, your first show in the United States is a big deal.
Totally.
Have you had a show in Paris, Mr. Fitzpatrick?
I'm about to.
Are you?
I'm about to, yeah.
We're working on it.
Yeah, I've just finished all the artwork for a body of work called The Absinthe Birds.
Yeah.
And the poem is, it's going to be a book. It'll be out in May. And I've also resumed making another body of work called Lunch Drawings, which are a biography of my childhood and with pictures, you know.
Wow.
So, and we're thinking both of these things are going to be stage shows as well. So we're...
Yeah.
We're cooking that.
It's about time you got back on stage.
Yeah, you know, I kind of miss
I agree,
you know?
Rick. It is about time I got back on stage. Oh,
exactly.
You're talking about both of you.
No, Max is acting now.
We just did a movie together. We just did Dreaming Grand Avenue.
Yeah, New City produced two movies this summer, and he's in both of them, and I'm in one of them called Dreaming Grand Avenue. Yeah, we're not in the same scene, so that's yet to be a
that's
thing.
Just,
but
that's just too much loveliness for one.
We're working on that, though. That'll be soon.
This is another aspect of this whole thing. There are very few people I know who know Chicago on a more intimate and incisive kind of level than does Tony Fitzpatrick. You are obviously going to, I don't know when you got, you and Lisa and Caetano, when you got here, but during your stay, and you're going to be here for the entire month? Will you be here for the...
You're going to New York for a little bit, right?
Yeah, I'm going to spend 1 week in New York.
Yeah. But you'll be here for a while.
Yeah.
What is it, Tony, you want to show them about Chicago?
You know,
what do you want them to know?
What I've done so far is I've introduced them to a good sushi place, a good French joint, a good burger joint. And then I kind of let people go find the city for themselves, you know, which is kind of how I navigated Paris. I just went out and walked.
Yeah.
You know, I went out and walked all over the city. And they went to the observatory this morning. They walked there.
Yes.
You know, they walked. They're Parisians, so they walked miles.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, anything they ask me about, I certainly tell them. They visited Central Camera, you know, on Wabash.
Sure.
Which has been there since 1892.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I would give them maybe the Studs or Algren kind of tour of the city. I mean, I don't...
Or what exists of the Algren part of the city.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, what I do not ever do is glamorize.
Oh, of course
and
not.
And what I don't ever do is haul people downtown to see the Bean.
Yeah.
We've gone around, you know, Humboldt, Logan Square, mm-hmm. Wicker Park.
They flew in on the negative 22 degree day, yeah. So they got to experience the coldest day in Chicago.
He's never been
I'm
that
so
cold.
I'm so surprised.
In his life.
I don't know you too well, but you both, I can sense from the two of you that you're both very smart, and I'm really surprised you didn't just get back on the plane and say, Tony, send me a check if anybody people buy my work.
Actually, they did everything to catch us. We spent more than 1 hour with the frozen door and the airplane. They couldn't open.
Yeah.
Welcome to Chicago.
Yeah, I went down to the baggage, and I'm seeing all the baggage, and then the place is practically empty, and I'm like, Jesus, this is how Stephen King novels start. You know, it's like, this could go sideways really quick. You know?
But listen, ladies and gentlemen, they stayed and they are staying at the Dime Gallery, 1513 Northwestern Avenue. The opening of the exhibition is Friday night, roughly 6 o'clock.
Free beer,
free parking, yeah. And save your money to buy
absolutely
photographs.
Definitely.
We'll be back with these fine people in a couple minutes. Chicago Knows Best, right? Hit up. You want to see? Listen to the stupidest commercial in the history of radio? Listen
Certainly.
To this.
Yeah.
Chicago Knows Best, right? Hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's Best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays at 10 p.m. on WGN TV. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. Well, you know what? It is 10 p.m.
Yeah.
And so if you're...
If you're watching TV...
If you're watching TV, you're a loser.
Yeah, exactly.
Total loser. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Musical selections by Ernie Skatton, who won some money on this year's incredibly boring Super Bowl. His bet was that this would be the most boring Super Bowl in the history of Super Bowls and playoff games and Bears preseason games anyway.
I wasn't even interested in watching this.
He would have been less after having watched it.
I just read Mike Leibovich's book called Big Game,
sure.
Which is about the culture of the NFL owners.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Terrifying. Well,
a bunch of toxic little Donald Trumps. You know,
you two, do you care anything about football?
Yeah, reason? But I wanted to add, it was the most boring game for the next years as well.
Really sloppily played, from what I heard. You know, I mean, these guys were telling
me. Well, the Rams were just awful. But look, Ernie is really, really, really.
Ernie, did you make some cake?
Yeah, I'm $10. I'm $10 richer. So
nice.
I'll go home, give it to my four children.
Yes,
$2.50 each. Good.
Yeah, you are.
Or you take a piece. You give them $2 each, and you save some.
Save some for the wife and me. I got
exactly.
it. Thank you.
Yeah. When you four people, Max, not so much you because you're not as the visual artist that these other three
right.
are. You're an actor and you run the gallery and you do a lot of other things and you sort of help monetize your dad's
artwork.
Because his dad's a business moron.
Dad is not. He's on the same level. He's in the Business Idiot Hall of Fame along with me. Tony and Lisa and Caetano. How do you feel when you see someone standing in front of and looking at a piece of your art?
I feel like I've done my job.
No matter the
people ask me, people always ask me, even if they disapprove. People always ask me, well, you know, who do you work for? And it's like, well, I tell them I work for you. I work for the kid who in 200 or 300 years might see one of these, and I will have engaged in a dialogue over a couple centuries, you know, much like Picasso did for me when I was a little kid. much like Chester Gould's work did for me, or Daumier, or Goya. Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I ever looked at a piece of art seriously, I was about 8 years old, and I saw Nighthawks.
That would be the one that would do it for
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Yeah, because I get it.
I was looking at it. My mother took me on the free day, and I'd begun drawing. I looked at it, and I thought, this is like a gangster movie.
Yeah.
And sure enough, years later, Jules Dessin, who made The Naked City, they said, well, how did you figure out that lighting, that brilliant? And he goes, Edward Hopper, Nighthawks.
Mm-hmm.
So these disciplines all talk to each other. And what you hope in your lifetime of making art is that in some way you're part of that conversation.
Caetano, what about you? And Lisa, I hate to keep putting the arm on you. You're being so kind and to translate.
I think one of the strongest aspects in Lisa's work is how she kept the eye contact with subject.
No question. No kidding.
Yeah.
When someone is staring at the art, is the same feeling that I have is she kept the eye contact with the audience, you know.
Wow.
So it's a link with someone who was shoot for the photography and the audience. I believe it's the same link, you know, the same connection that you can provide for the audience and the subject. I think it's very important.
There's a real cultural exchange that happens.
But that's very interesting because you're connecting human beings through a static image. That's an amazing.
That's
an amazing feeling. How about for you? That beautiful landscape that Max was talking about. That kind of shot of. I mean, it looks like a painting. I know that sounds here, Mr. Art Critic. That photograph looks like a painting. When someone looks at that, what do you imagine them thinking?
First thing is for this photography specifically, it was so hard to get on this place. And as Tony said, the work is done as a possibility to show people isolated place, make them new something that maybe they would never be able to be there, you know. Like to us, we spent 2 days to get on that place traveling.
Yeah.
We, even as a Brazilian citizens, we need a visa to get there, so it's a very restrict place to be.
Wow.
It's really, really hard, but it's like a paradise. It's amazing.
So, in a sense, you're showing people parts of the world that they might never see.
Exactly.
And Lisa is doing the same thing. She's showing them people they certainly, almost mm-hmm. certainly, will never, ever know. And your stuff, Tony.
And we also wonder, when I looked at the photos of the indigenous people, the Waro, from the Amazon, they've gone to great lengths to make themselves isolated from us, and you wonder...
Who could blame them?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm serious about that.
And I think when I look at the faces of the children, it's like, I would hide from the monsters, too.
Yeah.
You know? So there's this act of generosity, spiritually, translated into photographs that connects us. And
I know
you saw
had...
with Robert Capa, you saw
sure.
with... Ouija, with even Diane Arbus, there's this thing where we are more kin than we were before we looked at it.
You know, you're fascinated with photography, too, in mm-hmm. that you've had Michael James, photographer's work mm-hmm. there. Have you ever, and I don't want to use the
I'm
word,
not
toyed
a good photographer,
with, have
no.
you ever gotten interested to the point of exploring photography as an artist?
I'm fascinated by it, but I don't really have any facility with the mechanical object itself. You know, my friend Timmy Anderson's a marvelous photographer.
Sure. Yeah, sure, yeah.
And I know a lot of painters who are absolutely great photographers. I'm just not one of them. I collect photography. I mean, we've, you know, been collecting it since Michelle and I, since we got married, you know. I admire it greatly. It's like... It's like admiring ballet. It doesn't mean I can do it, you know.
Love that. That I didn't need you
exactly,
to tell me.
Exactly, yeah. It's one of those art forms that just requires this perfect moment.
Something different than you have.
Absolutely.
Max, what about you? I mean, I know you've been drawn to visual arts over the years.
Well, he makes films.
Ultimate visual art.
Yeah, in my beginning days of film school, I did have a camera and I did take pictures, but, you know, as you kind of venture into film school, you start to figure out more and more each year what you want to do. And I found myself more away from the camera and actually kind of relying on people to sort of help me with those decisions. You know, I'm not a cinematographer, and I think I'm a serviceable photographer in a way where I know what a good shot is. I know I can find something meaningful in a picture. But I'm just not dedicated enough to make it an everyday thing in my life. And I'd rather be in front of the camera than, you know, behind it.
Thing, you know, in not getting it, you open yourselves up to feel, I think, the wonder that is inherent in the work of these two people.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I'm sure another photographer could see your work and say, oh, well, technically that's this. That would mess it up for me. I want the pure wonder. It's like seeing something magic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I look at those and I have two thoughts. Who is this person? I wish I knew them. I wish there was a way I could enter their world for a minute and
great thing is you in a sense you have entered their world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it might be 10 below zero next Friday night. We don't know.
No.
But these amazing photographs will be in that room. And the people we don't know, people who are indigenous to the Amazon.
Well, it's a chance to take a trip.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
And the project they're working on of the 10 cities and the refugees in Paris. Yeah. At some point, I want that show as well because
it is bound to be a great show. You can go online. You can go to my Facebook page and you'll see links to these two amazing photographers and incredibly nice people. Their show opens Friday. Free beer, free parking. Mm-hmm. Dime Gallery, 1513 Northwestern Avenue. Tony Fitzpatrick will be there. He will be the person who looks the least like a ballet dancer. Max Fitzpatrick will be there. He looks like a young actor, filmmaker. Fellas, thanks a million, Tony.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Rick.
Kaitana, Lisa, I'm such an admirer of your work. And if you will learn, I guarantee you will learn to be fluent in English before Tony is fluent in French.
Yeah.
That's my bet. That's my Super Bowl.
By the time they're done staying with us, they're going to learn every bad word in
English. That's my Super Bowl Sunday bet. Thank you all
so much. Thanks for having us, man.
A happy Super Bowl Sunday again. That's over for another year. In my effort to lead people to the Studs Terkel archive, which exists in the wide world of the internet, I thought I'd replay something I did for it. You can go to studsterkel.wfmt.com and just screw around. One of the things, you don't have to listen to it after you listen to it tonight. Here is me reading a sort of, you know, biography take of the life and times of Studs Terkel. Louis Terkel arrived in Chicago as a child from New York, and here found not only a new name, Studs, but a place that perfectly matched in its energy, in its swagger, in its charms, and in its heart, his own personality. He and the city made a perfect and enduring pair. He was author, radio host, actor, activist, and Chicago symbol. He was also tireless. When he died at his home on Halloween in 2008, he was 96 years old, and at his bedside was a copy of his latest book, P.S., Further Thoughts from a Lifetime of Listening. It is hard to imagine a fuller life. A television institution for years, a radio staple for decades, a literary lion since 1967, when he wrote his first best-selling book at age 55. Louis Studs Terkel was born in New York on May 16, 1912. Studs said, "I came up the year the Titanic went down." He said that often. He moved with his family a few years later when they purchased the Grand Wells Hotel, a rooming house catering to a wide and colorful variety of people. He supplemented the life experiences in Chicago by visits to Bughouse Square, the park across the street from the Newberry Library that was, at the time, home to all manner of soapbox orators. Studs wrote, "I doubt whether I learned very much at the park. One thing I know, I delighted in it. Perhaps none of it made any sense, save for one kind, a sense of life." He attended the University of Chicago, where he obtained a law degree and borrowed his nickname from the character in the Studs Lonergan trilogy by Chicago writer James T. Farrell. He never practiced law. Instead, he took a job in the federally sponsored statistical project with the Federal Emergency Rehabilitation Administration, one of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal agencies. Then he found a spot in the Writers Project with the Works Progress Administration, writing plays and developing his acting skills. Studs worked on radio soap operas and stage plays and as a sportscaster and a disc jockey. His first radio program was called The Wax Museum, an eclectic selection of whatever sort of music struck his fancy, including the first recordings of Mahalia Jackson, who would become a dear friend. When television emerged as a force in the American home in the early 1950s, Studs was there, creating and hosting Studs Place, one of the major jewels in the legendary Chicago School of Television that also spawned Dave Garraway and Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. It was on Studs Place, which was set in a tavern, that large numbers of people discovered what Studs did best, talk and listen. Studs, arms waving, words exploding in bursts, leaning close to his companions, didn't merely conduct interviews, he engaged in conversations. He was interested in what he was talking about and whom he was talking to. But his TV career did not last. He later complained that commercialization of television forced his show and the others in the great Chicago school off the air. But also contributing at the time was McCarthyism, a potent force, and Studs was outspoken politically. With a highly liberal tone, Studs said, "I was blacklisted because I took certain positions on things and never retracted. I signed many petitions that were unfashionable for causes, and I never retracted." He had a very hard time finding work, subsisting on small speaking fees and even smaller sums for running book reviews. His wife, Ida, made enough to keep the family afloat. Studs said of her, "The first time I saw her, she was wearing a maroon dress. She made a lot more money than I did, too. It was like dating a CEO. I borrowed $20 from her on our first date, and I never paid her back." They were married on July 2, 1939, and Dan, their only child, was born 10 years later. Studs eventually found a new audience when he was hired at a new fine arts station, WFMT, where his brand of chatter, jazz, folk music, and good conversation became a perfect fit. His political views were more tolerated on the station, and Studs began his morning radio show in 1952. In the mid-60s, Studs was in his mid-50s, a time when many people begin to plan the end of their careers. Studs was about to start a new one. A British actress he had interviewed was so impressed with his technique that she told her friend, Andre Schifrin, a book publisher, all about Studs. Schifrin had remembered reading transcripts of some of Studs' radio interviews in a WFMT publication and remembered being impressed. So he contacted Studs, who had previously written a little-known book, Giants of Jazz, in 1957. And after much argument, he finally coaxed the radio personality into writing a book compiled from interviews with Chicagoans from all walks of life. Stud said, "I told Andre he must be out of his mind, but he relented." The result was Division Street America, published in 1967 to rave reviews and best-selling success. It told the stories in their own words of businessmen, prostitutes, Hispanics, blacks, ordinary working people who formed the unity of America and also the divisions in society. It was a theme that Studs would explore again and again. In Hard Times, his Depression-era memoir in 1970. In Working, his saga of the lives of ordinary working people in 1974. In American Dreams, Lost and Found in 1980. And The Good War, Remembrances of World War II, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1985. Most of his books were actually written radio. Studs asked questions and then listened. He drew out of people things they didn't know they had in them. Studs said, "I think of myself as an old-time craftsman. I've been doing this 5 days a week for more than 30 years. When I realize the work is slipping, I'll quit. But I don't think I've reached that point yet. I still have my enthusiasm. I still love what I do." And indeed, he was far from finished doing it. In 1986, he published Chicago, a big title for a 144-page book. He described it as a rambling essay, but it was more like a meditation, a distillation of much of what Studs had come to feel for a city that he was as closely identified with as those other uniquely compelling Chicago voices, Nelson Algren and Mike Royko, who were among Studs' dearest, closest friends. He captured the voices of the city, quoting recollections of Jesse Binford, an associate of Jane Addams, or Tom Carney, a police sergeant, to give human scale to history. His own voice was in there, too, in Chicago, in anecdotes and reminiscences about his family and growing up on Ashland and Flournoy, in a lovely little scene of him as a boy in the company of his sick father, passing the time together listening to a crystal radio set. His radio show remained vibrant, an 11 a.m. fixture for decades before moving to 5:30 in the late afternoon in the late 1980s. The human drama was his great theme. Conversation was his vocation and avocation. His brimming curiosity and feeling tone, as he called it, carried him into the hearts of the world. He bent a listening ear in Europe, South Africa, as well as all over the United States, and of course, all over Chicago. That is me reading about Studs Terkel in an attempt to drive you to the Studs Terkel archives, which contain and will contain eventually 5,000 hours of him interviewing such people as if you go there, call up Studs Terkel and Bob Dylan. You got to hear Studs interview the 23-year-old Bob Dylan. We're going to get some commercials, and then you will hear more of me doing my best to convince you to not forget Studs Terkel. Again, the song selections of Super Bowl winner Ernie Skatten. Here are a few more minutes of me finishing up the audio biography of Studs Terkel that you can find at just Google Studs Terkel Archives and you will be in for a feast. Here I am again. Thousands of celebrated names spilled from his interviews, but just as important, Studs sought the daydreams and 3 a.m. truths of many a person who never made a headline. They were all somebodies to him. Studs looked down on no one. Studs said, I become one of them, in a way. By being himself, Studs put others at ease. A young Marlon Brando was so intrigued during an hour-long radio session that he asked for a second hour and took over the show, trying to find out what made Studs tick. As his celebrity grew, many people gave Studs a sort of larger-than-life status that is just one step away from caricature. He was well known for his wardrobe, almost a costume that he chose many years before. A red checkered shirt, a loosened red tie, gray trousers, and a blue blazer. His wife Ida said Studs once had spotted a man at a party wearing a red checkered shirt and said, well, he had to have one just like it. He did own a blue checkered shirt, but rarely wore it. He always had a frazzled and rumpled look, as if he might have been a boxing promoter. But he might have looked even worse. As his wife Ida said, I have to take him out to the store to buy clothes. Otherwise, he would be dressed in rags. And he was indefatigable, juggling his daily radio shows and his frequent public appearances with a steady stream of books. He also played newspaper reporter Hugh Fullerton in the 1988 John Sayles film Eight Men Out about the Black Sox scandal of 1919. The books kept coming. In 1992, there was Race, What Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession, followed by 1995's Coming of Age, The Story of Our Century by Those Who Lived It, and 1997's My American Century. Along with them came dozens of awards, which Studs took with a typical lack of ego. In honor of his 80th birthday, the city named the Division Street Bridge for him. Noting that at the time, only two other Chicagoans, newspaper columnist Irv Kupcinet and broadcaster Paul Harvey, had been so honored, he said, Cup, Harvey, and Studs. It sounds like a law firm. In 1997, he went to the White House to receive the National Humanities Medal and the National Medal of Arts with a group that included Jason Robards and Angela Lansbury. He was stopped at the White House gate and asked for identification. Studs, who had never driven a car, did not have a driver's license. No identification. The only thing he could come up with to appease the White House guards was his CTA senior's bus pass. They let him in. His radio career ended in 1997 with its traditional sign-off. Take it easy, but take it. And he spent much of his time at the Chicago History Museum, which had become a repository for his 45 years of radio tapes and interviews from his books. These 9,000-some hours were called Vox Humana, the human voice, and they constituted the collected memory of our time. But his life was shattered in late 1999 when his wife, Ida, died of complications after heart valve replacement surgery. She and Studs had been married for more than 60 years, and many close to him felt that, given how much he relied on Ida for, well, for everything, he was a goner. Studs said, It's hard. It's very hard. She was 7 days older than me, and I would always joke that I married an older woman. That's the thing. Who's going to laugh at my jokes? At those jokes I've told a million times. That's the thing. Who's going to be there to laugh? Without that laughter, there was work. He did promotional events for his recently published The Spectator, talk about movies and plays with those who made them, a gathering of some of his best radio interviews. He set to work on Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Reflections on Death, Rebirth, and Hunger for Faith, published in 2001. Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Difficult Times, 2003. And another collection titled, And They All Sang, Reflections of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, 2005. He appeared and spoke at dozens of rallies for various causes and at literary events and sat for interviews with hundreds of reporters and TV types. In July 2004, he suffered a fall at his home. He required neck surgery and an extended hospital stay afterwards. He also needed full-time home care. But he kept at it, kept up that active schedule until the next year, when he added another item to his lengthy list of accomplishments, undergoing a very risky open-heart procedure to replace a narrowed aortic valve and redo one of the 5 coronary bypasses he had undergone 9 years before. His doctor said, "To my knowledge, Studs is the oldest patient to undergo this complex redo." The surgery lasted 6 hours. When Studs awoke, he began to call friends and say, "I am a medical miracle. A medical miracle, do you hear me?" Studs asked his doctor, "How long do you give me?" The doctor said, "Well, I'll give you to 99. Studs looked at him and said, "That's too long. I think I want a nice round number, like 95. After that operation, Studs began working on his memoir. It was called Touch and Go, and though Studs said it would be his last book, it was not. P.S., further thought from a lifetime of listening, came after that. Studs talked about that book at one of his last public appearances, which came in the summer of 2008 at the annual Printer's Row Book Fair, where he charmed a packed auditorium with a 30-minute monologue touching on everything from ancient Greek mythology to the upcoming presidential election. He seemed keenly aware, however, that the shadows were closing in. To touch his arms was to feel a living skeleton. But he displayed a mind still sharp with its ability to recall names, dates, and places from his lengthy and storied past. But he was facing the future, too. Stud said, "Remember those old Ivory Soap commercials? Ivory Soap, 99.44% pure. Well, I'm 99.44% dead." He would often sit in the sun-soaked living room of his house. The place was, as ever, a wonderful mess of papers, tapes, books, letters, photos, and visitors that so pleasantly cluttered his long life. It was in that living room when he said with zest that when he checked out, as a hotel kid, he rarely used the word dying, preferring the euphemism checking out and its variants, when he checked out, he wanted to be cremated. He wanted his ashes mixed with those of Ida, which sat in an urn in the living room of that house. Stud said, "My epitaph? My epitaph will be this. Curiosity did not kill this cat." He then said he wanted his and Ida's ashes to be scattered in Bughouse Square, that patch of green park that so informed his first years in his adopted, beloved city. Stud said, "Scatter us there. It's against the law. Let them sue us." And that's where they are today, Studs and Ida, lying near a lovely tree, summer, winter, spring, and fall. Okay, go to the Studs Terkel Archives. That was me trying to induce you to do that. Go to Google, Studs Terkel Archive, WFMT.